Action!
So, hey guys, welcome back. Last week we had Jim Jolliffe on DOP. And this week we've got Simon Rattigan, director. He's a personal friend of mine. I've known him for 20 years. We've worked together over the years. And he's had a really kind of wonderful career, actually, and really sort of developed his own style of storytelling. So we're going to break down some of his work and, you know, sort of pry a little bit into the sort of psychology behind the decisions he makes on the film set. How did the lockdown affect you personally? Did you carry on working through it? I think you did some jobs through it.
Yeah, I did. Actually, we were won a really massive job at Adam and Eve on Friday, and they were saying this is the last day we're going to be in on Monday. We're all working from home, and the job was for Halifax, and it involved 4 or 5 big locations around the country where 300 or 400 people will come together and make one of these Halifax X's.
All right. Okay.
So very, very quickly, that became an idea that wasn't going to run.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't even get 2 meters from our dog.
Yeah.
Let alone bring, you know, hundreds of people together in different parts of the country. So that just went away. Mm. And we all went home and it was totally, totally dead for a while. And I guess I was fiddling my thumbs and wanting to do something, and a few of us got together and just did a few kind of public broadcast things we just had made ourselves, just to say.
When you say a few of you got together, is that kind of like a syndicate of directors?
It was myself and the editor Paul Watts at the Quarry, and a creative.
These are people that you've worked with in the past.
They're people I knew or I'd worked with in the past.
Yeah,
and. You know, we came up with an idea and we just kind of made this thing and put it out there. So, you know, there was clearly people wanted to be doing something and they were at home. Mm. And even though the weather was really great, no one was really executing any ideas. I guess the agency people were still working on ideas and branding and print stuff and various things they could do from home. Mm. But in terms of kind of shooting material, it just wasn't happening. And no scripts were coming out. It was really quiet.
Did you find when you weren't shooting, did you find a kind of like a withdrawal that did you find that you needed to have that set experience? Did you really miss that, or could you find other creative?
No, outlets? I just started filming other things.
Mm. So you would find your own personal projects and just get involved.
Immediately,
right?
I think within like a week, I noticed this little bird. that they'd start these blue tit that started nesting just outside the kitchen window, and it would fly out and it would fly up against the glass and just peck the glass and would do that for about 5 minutes and then fly off, and then throughout the day 10-20 times it would come back and just peck at the glass more or less at the same point, and there were two windows in the kitchen, you know, 20 meters apart or whatever, and it would fly around the house to the other window and peck that window, but particularly this one out the back door. It would, every day,
the same bird.
Right. Well, it was a pair of blue tits, nesting blue tits,
right?
And I wasn't doing anything, mostly sitting in the garden drinking coffee, wine at night, and I kept on seeing this, and it was unusual, and the very fact it kept coming back to the very, very same spot, I thought, I've no idea why, but I should film this, because I can, it's repeatable. I can get different angles, different shots, different lights a day, because it keeps on doing this, and I've no idea why or how long it will do it, but let's do that. And so I started off with the camera way back in the kitchen, maybe about 5 meters from the window, and I'm moving very, very calmly, so there's no movement inside to frighten it, and it wouldn't really, you know, make any difference. And within 2 days, the camera was against the glass. The lens was against the glass, which is quite hard, because when it's pecking, if it's like an inch to one side or the other, you miss the shot.
Right.
And so, but it would keep on doing it. So I would just shoot hours of footage of this until I got it literally pecking on the lens.
In the middle of the lens.
And then I was going, actually, the light's not very good. I should shoot this early morning. I should shoot it late at night and different angles and just get, really just get more, how do I suck the most out of this? Because it's pretty interesting. Mm. And I'm shooting it at 100 frames and it keeps coming right to the camera from the garden. And eventually I took the camera outside and shot the reflections of it pecking at the window, and while I was doing this, we also researched online birds pecking at the window. What is going on? Because it was, it was like 10 days later, I'm still filming, getting more bolder and bolder with the bird.
Yeah.
It's not bothered by me at all. And it turns out that when they nest, they get kind of hyper-territorial and they see their reflection in the glass and they're simply trying to scare the other bird away.
Right.
And this window was maybe a meter and a half from there, their little bird box. And after about 3 weeks, it stopped, and they kind of did their thing. And then,
so it must have a memory of where that bird the bird thinks that other bird is, which is its reflection. Yeah. To come back to the same spot every time.
Yeah,
it has some
more or less the same spot. Yeah. So and there's always a bird.
It's like
there.
It goes back to find the bird in the same spot, and the bird's there.
Yeah, but it made for great filming. So I ended up cutting that into like a little charity thing about.
Yeah.
Fighting yourself,
right?
And the mental problems.
So you actually made it into a piece of work.
So I made it into a piece of work.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But that came off something which I was working on for Calm about 6 months before.
Yeah.
Which made it into an ad that I didn't make, but they had this footage.
Yeah.
And the idea was someone fighting an invisible enemy.
Right.
And they couldn't quite get the rights for it because an artist had done the work originally, and they were kind of stealing the artist's idea. We didn't really quite want to get involved because, we could have been sued for taking someone else's work and basically reproducing it. Mm. And so it didn't really happen. And so when I saw this, I thought, actually, this replaces that and could be better. So I phoned the creative and said, look, give me the marketing guy's name at Calm, and I'll phone him. I'll send him this thing. And so I sent him. He called back and said, we should do something. This is great. And then I heard nothing else. It just never happened.
Is Calm the charity?
Calm is,
suicide charity.
It's a kind of mental health.
Yeah, because I don't know if you know this, but Mark Chirac, that used to be at HLA, we did a Calm short film for them. Do you ever remember that? It's a guy who goes onto a rooftop. It's actually, the story was, it's a middle-aged man, very kind of paranoid,
and you think he's going to jump.
Yeah, and he passes this kid with a hood, and he's like flinching because he thinks the kid's going to. You think the kid's going to
rob
him?
That's right.
And then the kid ends up walking straight past and going to the edge of the roof and jumping off. And that was a charity job we did.
Yeah.
But I remember that being for Calm as well.
Yeah. No, so they're good. But it was just, I guess it was slightly filling space. And this really interesting thing happening right out. I mean, we couldn't even leave our houses. And yet, right there was something quite cinematic happening, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I'm going to film it.
But it's almost like the behind the scenes, the story around it is just as interesting as the actual event as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we learned about nesting habits of beaches.
Who would have thought that would be?
Yeah,
that'd be some new knowledge. Yeah,
yeah. So there was definitely a drive, but it's never a frustration, or an anxiety if I can't be on set or shoot something because I just have to walk down the road.
Yeah,
and I'll have an idea and then I'll start filming that.
But I have to say that is how you've always been. I've known you. I mean, the audience won't know this, but how long have we known each other? It must be over 20 years now.
Yeah. 25. Yeah.
I mean, we started in the industry together pretty much. I mean, you were advanced of me. I'd graduated in 95 and so, and I'm sure we started working in the beginning of 2000s or so, around. When were you?
It was that TNT shoot in the car park of that office block on Soho Square.
Yeah. Do you remember when that would have been? That was because we. I remember we were,
must be 90.
Yeah, late
90s.
Yeah,
2000.
Yeah.
So 23 years.
Yeah, and my point I'd like to make is that, and all that time I've known you were the first director that I believe had this sort of creative confidence that I worked with, that had this sort of creative confidence of just knowing that you would find something worth shooting regardless of what the circumstances were happening on set. So some directors I work with, they're very concerned about everything going according to what's the plan. And you seem to have no regard for that. you just had this inner confidence that we'd find something worth shooting. And it's almost like I felt the advertising agency came round to your way of seeing the world. You know, like when I look at the body of your work, and I'd like to discuss some of your jobs with you.
Sure.
But one thing that really strikes me is the fact that, you know, I actually showed the work to some of the guys here before you turned up, and the comment was
they said that you'd bored them.
I was going to say, you're right. Yeah.
No.
Quite the contrary. But but the comment was, how did Simon get the agency to trust him? Because it's clearly he's gone off and just caught, found things, because that stuff can't be set up. It's found. A lot of what you do is found.
Yeah, and I know where that's come from within me stylistically. But I don't quite know at what point or how I managed to persuade people to see things that way. There must have been a project.
Was it Lerpak was the one that I think is the first one that put that style on your showreel very clearly?
Yeah.
Is that the one that, because you first got the attention of the agency with the Channel 4.
The Iraq thing.
Yeah,
there was another spot which got me signed, that helped me get me signed before that at HLA, which was a thing I did for Discovery called Got to Know. They were rebranding themselves as a channel, as a network in the UK and also in the States. And somebody had come up with this line, which they loved, worldwide, Got to Know. Some things people have got to know about in the world. Mm. And that just seemed to be a nice tag for Discovery. Mm. And the guy who, David Abraham, who was in charge of, he then went on to run Channel 4, but he was running Discovery at the time. He managed to orchestrate this line being bought in by Discovery. Mm. And so he wanted to be in control of making something. And he came to me and he brought an advertising guy, high caliber guy in from the industry, and so that you two go away and think how we can film this, make it into an ad. We've got this line, Got to Know, what would be a great 60
second
commercial.
So he was a creative that was brought in.
An advertising creative. And so I suppose I was working for them in the broadcast department of Discovery.
And what were you doing at the
just making kind of program trailers and but filming stuff. So we would be promoting like a season of films or a new season of programs or maybe some interviews they were doing, whatever the programming was.
But you would be doing part producing, part directing, part editing. I remember that you did the whole the whole thing, which back then was actually, I don't think people realize how rare that was, because people, traditionally, you were brought into the film industry through one of the sort of crafts. You were an editor, and maybe then you became a director later down in your career, later along in your career, or you're a producer, and if you're a producer, you stayed a producer, or a cinematographer, whatever. But the thing that always struck me about working with you, you were kind of sort of multi-skilled, because
there was a whole team of, a whole raft of creatives working in the kind of promotions department of TV channels and cable networks, just making trailers, and they were called producers. And really, to do the job, you had to learn to write, and you had to learn to edit. Mm. And in general, you'd start off just using program material.
Right.
So whether it was for seasonal on The Simpsons, or whether it's a movie, or whether it was a documentary season coming up about Iraq, like that thing for Channel 4 I did. There would be different reasons you'd be doing something. Maybe it's just a Christmas thing or an Easter 2-week holiday break for the kids, and they want some. And we see it with the BBC at the moment. Big kind of lavish things they do for the Olympics and Christmas and sport events, various things like that. And these trailer makers invariably were dealing with found footage, stuff that was in the programs themselves. And maybe the idea, they would have to come up with an idea that might involve copy, it might just be the images, but they had to write, and so often they would edit them themselves.
So you'd write an idea, present it, and then if it got approved, you'd be given the footage.
You'd make it. Sometimes you could get editors in for those people who couldn't edit. I think when I first started, we would have it edited for us, because I guess there wasn't just the means for people to edit themselves, and there wasn't the knowledge base. People could have an idea and write a few words on paper, but the process of editing stuff, you'd bring people in. But I think early on, when Avid began to appear and we were using that and we were allowed to kind of learn on that, I immediately thought, I need to learn how to do this. This is a really useful
tool.
And
you learned within the institution how to edit?
Within the broadcasters, yeah. So wherever I went, there would be Avid suites.
And
so
you self-taught? How do you...
Yeah, I guess so. But, you sit looking over the shoulder of an editor. Mm. You begin to understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
and you'd ask a few questions and then you'd have a go. And my biggest problem was just trying to get the footage into the machine and get the footage out again. You know, once you learn the buttons, it's great. Yeah, yeah. But how do I get it out onto tape or you know, to broadcast? So there were hurdles, but it just knew editing was such a useful tool to have. And then as I suppose I became more mature in that role and more experienced, the projects got bigger. I started to freelance with different broadcasters, and then the need for filming, you know, for shooting came along. Sometimes you know, they had a season of films or some programs or documentaries and they hadn't even had them delivered yet. There was no material.
During this process, were you, did you have it in mind that you were a director just on the path to becoming a director fully fledged, or did you could we go back, actually, could we go back to pre this promo broadcast?
Yeah.
What did you study at college? I don't even think we've had this conversation.
So I left school, went to college to do a degree in hotel management.
Right, we definitely have not had this conversation.
I don't know why. Well, I kind of do know why, but it's another story.
I can imagine you, just to say, I can imagine you as a great hotel manager, as along with being a great director.
Well, I think
so good with people.
I think I got into it thinking that I really, and this is a retrospective thought I've had, because I realize it's the same thing as filmmaking, and you may not understand that. Let me elucidate. I think what I wanted to do was make experiences for people. And when you go to a restaurant, or when you walk into a hotel, or any kind of hospitality thing or event, you know, the moment you get out of the cab or get out of the train or walk through those doors, you're thinking something. You're thinking, this feels good. This is going to be great.
Yeah.
You know, someone's party. This is going to be a good night. The moment you walk through the entrance, you're feeling something.
So it's like a curated event.
Yeah. And when you leave at the end of that, you're going, God, we must go back there. That was just great.
Right.
And I thought, I want to. That's good. I like to be able to build and curate those experiences. And of course, I got to college, and as a course was called hotel management. It was about managing hotels. I thought, actually, no, I don't want to run a hotel. I don't want to manage a restaurant. I don't want to worry about the chef and, you know, how many bookings we've got that night, and have we had a delivery of oranges.
It's the creative part.
I'm just not interested in that. I just want, when you walk up and you see it, you're already beginning to feel it, and you see the menus and the people who come up to you and say, how are you, have a seat, just all of those things, those experiential things, that I think excited me. And the course was just didn't teach me any of that.
Right.
Well it just assumed that, well, it was something else. It was literally about how to run these places. And I thought, no, I just don't want to spend my life running.
Was there anything you got from the course that you think is useful now as a director, that teach you about people management? Or
I'm sure there's lots of things that I'm probably not even aware of.
It was a degree course.
It was a degree, yeah. Right. It was a degree course.
And what did you, going back before then, how were you at school? What were your favourite subjects at school?
I guess they were art, although I didn't take A-level art. And math. I did take A-level maths. Some bizarrely maths and art.
Well, that's a perfect combination for a cinematographer, actually.
Whether that's good as a director, I don't know. But I just didn't fully embrace a creative side. I clearly had one, and just didn't really focus on it or recognize it for what it wanted to be. It was going to come out.
Did your parents encourage you at all?
They encouraged me in whatever way.
I wanted to do
a hotel management course. Great. You know,
they just wanted you to succeed, but they just wanted me to be happy and
to do what I wanted to do. Yeah.
And what did your parents do for a living?
Well, my dad was a painter, and he wrote. He was like an industrial editor, so he'd write for kind of company magazines and things. But he went to art college, he went to Camberwell School of Art, and he started his career illustrating science fiction covers. So, and he was painting until he died, so that was really his thing. And I guess, and my mum was, she worked in publishing, but also a draftsman, she would draw. So, you know, a relatively creative. background. And my brother, who left school before me, you know, he went to art college to do a degree in graphics and ended up being a photographer. So there's lots of creative people around me. And I just guess I just thought it was not going to be something that I could make a living out of, a proper living.
Interesting. So you're kind of being quite practical.
Totally being had my practical head on. And yet everything I touched, I liked doing, but I just didn't want to do it as a career. And even the, you know, the college thing, I had great fun at college and finished it. But I knew very, very early on that I wasn't going to be running a hotel. But I suppose it did teach me, like a lot of degrees do, that the self-sufficiency of work. And you're just by yourself in a room. You're writing something. You know, no one's going to help you here. You just got to do the work, and something will come from it. And I guess that I do. I did it last night. You know, I'm writing treatment by myself in a room. It's late. I'd really prefer to have a glass of wine or watch telly, but I'm just going to stay here and
it's like a kind of intellectual stamina that university gives you, isn't it? Where you can work through something.
Recognize that you're capable of that. Yeah,
that's a big thing for me. I was dyslexic, so when I went to university, I didn't even know how to write an essay properly. And I had an amazing English teacher. I did an access course, and I had an amazing English teacher that literally taught me probably grade one English that I needed to survive. And she said, you know, this is how you structure things. And the moment a word processor came out and I could structure it in my head, then that was just like I could actually engage in a professional world that I previously couldn't have done. So for me, that was, and I can still recognize those lessons that I learned back then. I'm still applying them now.
Useful.
Because communication is so important for what we do, isn't it? I mean, people think that you can have a great idea for a film and then somehow it magically happens. But unless you can communicate that to a group of people, and it's kind of like what you taught me, is how you inspire people to kind of be willing to kind of to do what you need of them to get something made. That's a big, deep people skill that, you know, took me years to learn. You seem to have it quite naturally. I remember when we went to South Africa, and we had some difficult characters that we were working with. Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
And just the way you managed that was, for me, was like a real eye-opener, because I'd never seen it done so kind of expertly before, that, you know, that you could get the best out of any situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's not something that I've learned or honed. It just is what it is. I guess there's some commonality with, you know, hospitality.
Yeah.
You know, you're working as teams.
Yeah.
You're relying on people in different places to do something at a certain time. You know, you just got to trust them. And
but I wouldn't naturally have associated those two skills, being a director and having that hospitality skill, being so important. But clearly, I mean, I think it's one of the ingredients of your success, is the fact that you can get the best out of people. Some directors have this kind of aloofness where they don't really communicate, and they need a really good producer, or they need a really communicative DOP, or, you know, set designer, whatever it is. But you've always been really self-sufficient.
To do that.
Yeah, like you just demonstrated it when you're talking about the Blue Tit film you made. You actually don't need any of that infrastructure around you to go and just make creative projects. And one of the things I wanted to ask you when we get more into your work is, it's hard to tell the size, the scale of the crew, or even the scale of the job. When you see a finished Simon Rattigan piece, I'm wondering, did he go and do that on his own? Or did he work with Martin Hill on that one? Or did he have a big crew and just go off? Because I remember there's times when we worked together when we had the kind of standard crew and the standard sort of commercials, you know, structure. And what you would try and do is escape that and then try and find the authentic happening going on outside of that. And it reminded me of there's a filmmaker, Barry Aykroyd, who's a cinematographer, and he came through document. I've always thought you had a kind of interesting documentary slant to the way you approach projects, but he was a documentary cameraman, and then he started doing big films, and he had this thing of setting up a decoy situation with the A camera, which wasn't him. He didn't operate the A camera, he let someone else operate that, and he'd get his almost as documentary camera, and you go around the outskirts of that, finding the moments that were authentic, because everyone was so focused on the ache. And I kind of, that sort of decoy thing, I see you, that's a sort of technique that I think you use as well. Just,
yeah, I mean, there's always a second camera, and I guess I've got better at using that myself, or if it's a a complicated scene, I will run the main camera with the circus behind me going, yes, we'd like this. And the DOP can take the second camera and go and shoot stuff. And I you know, it's always good. It's always better. And there's other stuff. There's just other stuff they found, you know, because they're just not part of those long conversations. You know, we'll shoot something and then we'll have discussions. They're just still shooting while while the cast or the dog or whatever the scene may be is playing out. There's little moments going on and that, you know, those go in the cut. Yeah, it's that other stuff. That's where all the magic is. Because commercials is such a, under normal circumstances, it's such a huge fake that it is very, very hard to deconstruct that down in order to capture something genuine and real. It's really hard. And the whole process, and it's not just on camera. You know, the moment somebody comes to set, they're great. And then they a cast member, and they vanish and they come back 40 minutes later. They've been through wardrobe, been through makeup. There's someone else. Not just because they look slightly different, they just are someone else. They're in someone else's clothes. They've got someone else who's done their makeup. They're not quite sure who they're meant to be. And actually, so now I generally try not to use wardrobe or makeup. You know, the makeup, they always look at me and I just go, don't touch them, you know, because I don't want to change them. And if I can get them to wear their own clothes, just any little slither of reality that I can get in helps.
Yeah,
I don't even know how it helps. And sometimes I think I'm kidding myself, and I get a great effort to, okay, well, let's get his real granddad. Let's not get an old granddad or whatever. Just you know, sometimes those things can be really painful to organize, and I'm not quite sure why I'm doing it, because actually maybe the granddad doesn't really have you know, isn't involved, and he lives up in Birmingham somewhere. It's like 2 hours to get him to set, whereas we can just find an old man, you know, through an agency in London, and he's not really involved in the scene, and all the time you're thinking, we probably just could have saved some money and saved some time just by not doing this. And then there's a little moment on camera, a little moment, a wink, a nudge, a little something, and I think that's great, because that wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't have happened if that was an actor.
Yeah,
they just wouldn't have known each other. They would play the granddad kid role, but it just sometimes is a little something, and particularly if you've got them to do something a little bit, you know, a little bit too sweet, a bit too cheesy, it just will be massively cheesy. But if they're real, then that hug or that smile or that little laugh will be there'll be a genuine little bit of something in that laugh, and it makes it okay. But it's hard, because, you know, advertising is full of lights and people and cameras, and it's just very hard for people to be natural. And it's very hard to find those moments.
If you had a choice, would you prefer to work with street cast, real people, as opposed to actors?
I think I prefer street cast people, real people. But it totally depends on the role. You know, if you've got a role where something is repeated again and again. Or it's very difficult, you know, they're really having to get into character, then you've got to use actors. I totally wouldn't do it any other way. But if they're doing something, I did a thing recently for TfL about a cyclist and a driver having a near accident, and actually it aired for about a couple of weeks, and then it was taken off because the cyclist brigade was saying, this is bad, you're promoting well, you're reinforcing that, you know, that drivers can drive the way they drive, and it was just being really just. It was a hugely balanced piece of work. But anyway, if you're a cyclist, you took offence to it. Anyway, it involves a female driver and a guy on a bike, and they have this near accident, and then they're screaming at each other through the window, but you don't hear them. They're screaming. You just see them.
Yeah.
You know, the actions. And obviously they are screaming. We're just, you know, used to, you know, the audience just doesn't hear the noise, but you hear their thoughts. And that, you know, and that was going to be very, very hard to do with real people, just because they had to kind of, from a standing start, get into that point of you've almost died or you've almost run someone over, and you're angry and you're frustrated and you're a bit scared and shocked by it. And, you know, that needs to be convincing. And it's actors all the way.
And do you, so with actors, do you Is it, do you have that kind of belief that you just cast the right person and then they're going to do it? Or do you have a sort of process that you have to go through with them on set?
I think most of it is finding the right person. Mm. The people who are naturally giving you as much of the character that you're looking for. There's always stuff on set because the audition and the casting process is slightly different to when they're there. So it always requires guidance. But I guess it's finding people closest to what you need. Mm. With the potential just to go a little bit further, and then on set, just really giving them freedom.
And do you always have something in mind when you're casting, or do you sometimes get surprised by someone that you had an idea for a character, and then you find someone that's completely not that character, but they surprise you in a way that...
Yeah, I think that happens a lot. I think more importantly, you have a way of playing a scene, and when you're giving people a relatively broad remit in the auditions to play out something for 60 seconds, there are things that they do that are just great. You know, you'll get this insight into what maybe a real person would do. That's exactly right. That's what you would do, isn't it? I hadn't even thought of that. Mm. And so I locked that away. Mm. And one that makes them, that particular, cast member, that elevates them, but they may be wrong for other reasons. Right. But I keep the behavior. So I find casting can be surprising in terms of who you come away with. Mm. But it's really surprising in terms of that what people do. Some people obviously just get it totally wrong. Some people just come in and understand what this person would do in those circumstances, and others just do stuff that you think that's just an easy grab. We can do that on the day. Get them to do that. Mm. It's either part of their action or it's a little close up, but that's a nice touch. Mm. And often it can solve a script. You know, it could be something, how do we end? How do we get onto the next scene? How do we get into this scene? Mm. And it's something in the casting, you see a bit of behavior. Mm. You think that's a great link. Mm. Because you've got, dozens of people coming in and just playing that role for a couple of minutes. And it's really revealing.
Let's talk a little bit about the script stage then, because when you first get a script in, because you said solve the problem with the script. I remember talking to you years ago and you were saying the trick is to try and get, a 6 out of 10 idea and make it an 8 out of 10 idea. And occasionally, very occasionally, you get, an 8 out of 10 idea, and then hopefully you can make that a 10 out of 10 idea. But most of the scripts that float around are between sort of probably 4 and 6, would they be?
So yeah, it's a wide variety, and not many that come out which are 8 and 9s out of an agency.
Right.
So, and that's not always, it's not the agency's fault. There's probably a lot of great 10 out of 10 scripts written. They just get compromised.
Yeah, so that's...
Everything is compromised.
Right, so they might start out as a 10 out of 10, out of 10 idea, but then they get whittled down, like the old adage, and what's it, a racehorse designed by a committee is a camel kind of thing, where it's a... And I think that's very true of agency. I was listening to another director talking at Rogue Films, a big director at Rogue, Sam Brown.
Yeah.
And he was basically saying his job is getting the agency to remember the initial idea they wrote and to have confidence back in that. Because correct. That process they've been through of taking that idea to bits has actually ruined the idea. Do you find that's true for...
Yeah, I would say for most scripts. And often when I'm in a meeting, the first thing I will talk about is are the problems in a script. And they're always really obvious. It's either something that doesn't really work or shouldn't really be there. It just feels like suddenly we're in another place, or it just kind of won't work. And the better the script, the more they stand out. Mm. Because you're into a flow of something going, this is really great. And then just something happens. And 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, it's because the client has said something.
Yeah, right.
Or the account department has said, look, client really wants this to happen or this to be a feature of the film. And they just had to work it in. And they've probably done a really great job, but you read it.
You can spot it straight away.
Yes, yeah. Totally.
But then politically, how do you manage that? Because are you in a danger of losing the job because you're basically telling them that for you to do it justice, you need to take that bit out? But that's the bit that they've already agreed with the agency.
I think you just explore the how much of a problem it is. Is it really damaging what might be done? If you're talking to people who don't think it's a problem, you're not going to get the job. Because they're simply either going to take offense that you think there's something wrong with their script, or they just feel that there's some kind of, you know, mismatch.
Right.
Between idea and director.
So would that first conversation you have with the agents be an honest conversation?
Totally.
Yeah. So you're always straight with them about the script.
Pointless being not honest. Yeah. Because I'm just trying to make the best film possible.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, you know, I might have to do a lot of, you know, persuading, cajoling. But I've totally got to be at one with the creatives. And I can't be that if I think there's a hole or a crack. In the idea, and you know, the vast majority of the time you can say, look, I'm not too sure about this section here, and they will just simply say, yeah, we didn't like that either. So then immediately, instead of it being what will you do, it's okay, what should we do? So you're agreeing, you're already
part of the team.
Do we need to do this? Yes, we do. Okay, fine. Well, wouldn't it be, and then the directing head comes on, or just the creative head. Something, I'm not even directing at this point. Or maybe we should just, like, they're all close-ups. Maybe at this point we should just move away, just so we, you know, or whatever the fix might be, and you start to explore fixes. And just some will resonate, and then they'll go, that's great. Yeah, that fixes that hole. And then the job's yours. Because you're fixing things. You've already made that 6 out of 10 or 7. And you're trying to smooth out those wrinkles which are very obvious in a script.
So is it always a strategy of working with the agency as closely as you can on just, you know, being sort of one of their team members? And then how does that translate to when you're actually on the set taking their notes?
I think it depends on the creatives and the type of idea and how much liberty I'm being given to kind of do my own thing. But I think it is really it's a team process. It has to be really collaborative.
Because the one thing that I wanted to, you know, one of the things I wanted to point out about your work is that, you know, like going back to this point we were making earlier about the trust that they must have in you for you to go off piste and go and find these magic moments that normally in the normal structure of a commercial are very, very hard to find, right? So you've got this technique, this way of working where you can go and find these moments. They have to trust you with that. Now, as your body of work has grown, that's an easier leap of faith for them to make in you, because they can see how you've made previous pieces of work, and that's what they want. They bought into that as a process. How hard was that at the beginning, though, when you didn't have that body of work? And
yeah, I was trying to think, you know, what piece of work I started to do that would just begin to show itself. I think there has always been, still is. I mean, I'm working on treatment right now, and one of the problems will be, they've said up front, is persuading the client that you're just going to go off for a couple of days with a small crew. And of course, that will be, and I've been very, very clear, everything we shoot on the main shoot days won't be as good as what we find when we go by ourselves. So I'm telling you that right now, what we shoot with everyone's money and everyone there will not be as good as the next 2 days. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, and that's always true of everything.
Yeah. So I think it's in everyone's interest that we get a couple of days just doing our own thing.
Yeah, right. So
and agencies get that, but of course that enthusiasm and trust for you know, us going out to find some magic, and often they'll come, you know, won't be everybody, but one or two people will come with us, and we'll have a huge amount of fun and just find great little moments, and everyone suddenly really is a filmmaker. Everyone is looking for little things, looking for individual people, having an idea. Wouldn't it be great if I had somebody get on the train with a dog and get off with a parrot or something, you know, or just whatever it may be. Everyone's thinking, and we go, yeah, actually we could make that happen, or we could find that, or that would be a good way of shooting that kind of scene.
So this is going back to you as the hotel manager having this kind of creative experience of people also kind of jump aboard. So you're like saying to the agency, let's jump aboard this creative experience and go off and find this stuff in the ether, kind of thing.
No, it's really rewarding for everyone. But clients have come around. I guess the body of work has helped, but I think it's been more to do with that second, that third camera. when you've got a plan, you've got a storyboard, you know what your shots are. It's just the ability to know, and of course I've got better and better at knowing where those little kind of gaps I can either run off or send someone off to go and shoot something, or just where to have another camera. And
how much do you think
collect that stuff,
how much do you think that coincided with the 5D, Canon 5D coming out? Because I remember it was mid-career for both of us when that first came out about, and you sort of embraced it very, very quickly. And that sort of that idea of the second camera and going off and finding footage that looks cinematic with a DSLR that's kind of a hidden, I think that lends itself a lot to your aesthetic.
Yeah, well, I think the 5D was seminal in that it dragged me into being an operator. Drag sounds like I was an unwilling. it allowed me in.
Yeah,
and I jumped.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a reasonably good eye, but you know, it needed refining and working, but the desire to be able to capture other stuff that I keep on seeing or missing. But before that, you know, there was always a second Alexa, there was a couple of 35mm, you know, a couple of Arris, you know, and a lot of the work I was doing, because there was a certain kind of naturalism in it, and it was just people stuff, there would always be a roving camera, and operators and DOPs would always be briefed just to not just shoot, not just turn over and shoot when we say action, but just to keep the camera rolling, look for other things, because while other stuff's going on, something might be happening in frame, and just turn on that. And there were a couple of big things I did for Orange, and this thing for Discovery I did. You know, it was just about, there were lots of opportunities for people, for camera people to film with big cameras on tripods, hard to move, B-roll stuff, and even handheld. And that, and even then in the edits, that stuff was always really good.
Yeah.
So I guess the 5D now, I use a Sony A7S.
Yeah.
They just simply allowed me to do it.
Yeah.
Really cost effectively. But it was always, it's always been great to have those other cameras. They're just worth their weight in gold.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your work. We're hoping our audience, what they'll do is they'll go onto your website and look at your work on the website. So it'd be nice to talk about some of the stuff that is actually currently on the HLA website.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's start historically. So we spoke earlier about let's talk about the Sony job, the foam job, because that's an example of setting up an event and having multiple cameras shooting it. Is that what happened?
Yes.
Was that the first time? Because you did the Orange ad before that, didn't you? Where you had the inflatable animals.
Yeah. Which is another kind of big multi-camera setup.
Was that the first time you'd done that kind of event, setting up an event and having multiple cameras?
I think it was, yeah. For some reason, I got that job because I felt that I'd done that before. But I think that was the first proper event job. Yeah. I think there was a string of kind of event jobs. I think the event as a theme for an ad became quite a thing. That was, and I was still, you know, pretty new. I'd only really been directing for 3 or 4 years, and it was a big job, and just knowing where to put the cameras and how to film things. I just feel, you know, it went fine, but I know the first we shot in Spain on that Orange job, the first at the end of it was just absolutely in rags. And because he just, you know, I wouldn't allow him to set the next shot up. I wasn't quite sure what the next shot was going to be. And he just couldn't be efficient. And so behind the scenes, he was just desperately trying to kind of juggle all these balls. And I would just be, you know, just reacting because I hadn't quite polished how to run a lot of people and several cameras and all these events, all that needed to be filmed. In a calm way. I was still a little bit kind of crazy with it. I remember Bob Pender Hughes shooting it for me, and I remember at one point running up to him. I've always given people a lot of freedom to shoot whatever they're going to shoot, because that allows me to shoot something else. I don't need to stand over your shoulder. You're a good DOP. You just go and do your thing. These people, they're going to do that, and I'll just go somewhere else. And So he was doing one of these things, and I ran up. For some reason, I needed him. And you're standing with this camera like this, and there's people around him. He's trying to shoot a close-up of whatever it might have been, something that he had organized with the first. And I'm just giving him lots of questions. Like, I need you, I need you. And he just calmly turns to me and says, Simon, I can't do two things at once. And he was really stern.
Yeah.
There was no, it was like, go away, let me finish this.
Yeah.
You know, there was no room. He had no headspace for anything else. And I just seemed to, that really just burnt into my memory. There was something about that moment. But okay, fine, this is a little bit too hectic. Either I need to be more, you know, self-reliant. If I'm going to let people go and do these things, I just have to let them do it. I can't then be kind of dragging them back all the time, because that takes them a while to polish that scene. Even if it's still kind of random, they need to work through it. And having me in their ear, because I happen to be the DOP, that's not going to help. Just go and do your thing. So that calmed me slightly, rather than...
Interesting.
Okay, let him do that. Can't do two things at once. And then when we got to that Sony job,
Sony phone.
Sony phone. I was still slightly in this slightly mad world. Everything had to be real. Everything had to be spontaneous. And of course, we've got massive machines that make foam, and we've got a fair few cameras, crews, and they need to know where they're going to be. And we, on the recce during the weeks prior to the shoot, I just wouldn't tell the first where I wanted the cameras because I had no idea where, and I really wanted it to be an event, like a carnival. This thing suddenly happens and just let people come. And as they come, we'll film them. And he goes, but okay, well, where's the event and where might the people come from?
Yeah.
And of course, he was, experienced American first, and he understands that the naturalism comes in another way. We're filmmaking here. We're not actually creating an event where we just film the general public. We need to keep the public out. The people who are going to wander in are going to be our extras. It's not quite, you can't do this as if it's for real. And I think I just needed to learn that. And off the back of the Orange ad and the Sony foam ad, I really began to kind of understand, these aren't real events. So where do I need people, and where do I need the cameras, so that I'm capturing bits that are real within this kind of construct. And because both those events were so big and so many people involved, and particularly the foam thing, because we're in a living, breathing downtown Miami, there was people that would just react to the phone who weren't our extras. And everyone was briefed just to kind of capture stuff. There's one shot of a girl, she's on her balcony, she's on her phone, and she just kind of points, and it's totally genuine. It's not like getting an actor up there saying that when the phone flies past, just kind of point to it as if you're a bit surprised. That is always going to be bad.
Yeah,
I just wouldn't even say that, because I just know it's just going to be some really hokey piece of performance from an extra. But a real person, just they're not acting. They're just going and it's just glorious. And so everyone is just briefed to look out for those moments. And then we'll send a guy with a a form up to that floor, knock on her door, get her to sign a release form, because that's a moment. And then you realize that, of course, some cameras need to be on the action, but the other cameras just need to be just with no brief. If nothing's happening, shoot this, but look around.
Yeah, see,
absolute freedom. I think the bottom line is freedom.
Freedom. Yeah, I was just about to say that you found a way of structuring it, so you built the freedom into the structure, whereas before it was the desire for freedom but without the structure.
Yes.
And now you've got the structure, and you know how you can build the freedom.
People were going crazy. They were just so desperate for structure, because they're used to structure. They're used to being told where the camera starts, where the person starts, what they're doing, where they end. And I didn't want any of that. And so, I had to learn that. I suppose is my has been my biggest education. Is okay. So we have to construct the fake place, and then how do we make it real? Yeah, so within the stage is set.
Yeah.
And so now actually I can do that in a kitchen with a family. I don't need to be out there with lots of kind of general public and wind and passing cars.
Sorry to butt in. The British Gas one, for example. That's a real family, is it? Were they?
It's a real family.
Real family, yeah. Because they really came across as a real family.
Yeah, yeah. And not their kitchen. So, you know, it's a different house, different bathroom. Mm. There's a, you know, they're in one really small room. Mm. It's hard. Also, it's done as a POV thing. Mm. So there's already like a...
What size camera did you use to get the arms around? Was it just a normal size camera?
I think we used a Venice because
you could take it off the...
Because you could have got the detachable, whatever it's called. It has a name, isn't it? So basically the detachable lens with its umbilical cord is about the size of a Canon 5D with a matte box on it.
Yeah.
So you can get that pretty close to people and you can wrap arms around it.
Yeah.
And so the main woman, the mum, who was there, so it wasn't just the cameraman. I think occasionally it was just the cameraman where it just became too difficult to get the shot. Mm. But invariably it was the mum because
you want the kids to react to the mum. You don't want the kids to react to a cameraman that they don't even know.
Quite.
Right? Yeah.
But actually they have to react to the camera. That was the problem.
The eye line.
The eye line. Because the inherent thing is a lie. You cannot be the mum. Mm. It's a camera. Mm. So everything has to be to the camera. And so and often their eyes will flick.
You can see them darting off and coming.
And so we're just having to edit around that. But you just need a couple of good moments where they're looking at the camera. Mm. And just having their mum there talking to them, they soon get that and they just kind of play along. And very written scenes, you know. But, you know, there's a little spider scene. You know, we found a spider. And we thought, oh, this is great. You know, I think we were going to be taking, like, hair out of the plug. But there was a spider in the bath. I was like, okay, great.
Yeah.
Let that be one of the moments, you know. And I think those are the things that... That's why I'm so relaxed. Because if we just put a family in a bathroom, we're going to find stuff. Mm. And if we just go through the motions of having a bath, having a shower, shaving, bloody nose. If we just go through those things, other stuff's going to happen. Mm. And we're throwing dogs in there and footballs and other things to create...
To create a bit of chaos.
Well, yeah. to create the unexpected. Mm. Mm. You know, it doesn't really matter. In fact, I'm not quite sure if the dog made the cut. I think there was a very brief dog shot. I just ordered the maddest dog possible. Mm. And so, okay, well, we're just going to bath the dog.
Mm.
And there isn't a plan. There's no plan where the dog comes in or where it goes out or how wet it gets or how it should be dealt with. All we're going to do is we're going to give you a dog, and which we know because we talked to the dog wranglers, it's happy to be bathed. And we'll just get the family to bath it and we'll just film it because we're going to get the best stuff. And if there's something that's really brilliant that everyone goes, God, that's brilliant, but the camera shook or a hand came in or the boom came in, then we go back and get it again. But it's really trying to keep that flow of freedom.
The freshness of it.
Because they will do, who knows, and actually as it happens, the dog was useless. The dog was so calm, which is why actually...
I don't think it made the cut.
No, maybe it didn't.
But I remember
there was no chaos. It went in the bath.
I remember catching a spider, though. That's one of the memorable
shots. And the lady turned out to be, it was a phobia. Mm. She had a phobia about spiders. And we go, oh. And by this time, we've mentioned it to the agency, and they've talked to the client, and the client don't like the spider idea. And I go, look, the spider's there. This is filming. We're here in the bathroom. It's there. Mm. Someone's going to take the spider out of the bath. So let's just do it for real. Yeah. Otherwise, the art department will do it in 10 seconds. And then we won't. Then we'll be trying to find a spider.
Let's just
shoot the spider.
That's such a classic example of having to go through the chain of command.
By
the time the spider's fucked off, do you know what I mean? It's like, Jesus.
And I think that was it. I said, look, I'll go downstairs and I'll talk to them. Just shoot the spider. And then I came back and they hadn't done anything. And he said, oh, no, our cast, the mum, she's whatever the name for spider phobia is.
Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia, thank you. She's arachnophobic. But she said, no, I'll do it. It's okay, I'll do it. And she was tearful at the end, but actually she put this little kind of, gave her this tiny little plastic cup. So it was really close to her fingers and she kind of scooped it up and then she had to wait and you had to open the window and then she had to do that. She was great, but she had tears. There's something about
the resonance of that shot that made it feel really real.
Well, it was just a moment.
There's something there. You spot that.
I think that, and I'm always my radar is you know, out for that, those kind of moments. And it's just worth trimming time on another on another shot just to grab those.
Yeah.
They just, and they don't, the cut doesn't have to be full of them.
Yeah.
It just needs to be peppered with a few of those moments, and it lifts everything.
Well, it makes everything feel authentic then, doesn't it? Because it's kind of the shots that clearly are authentic kind of pollute the other shots' inauthenticity into being more authentic in a way.
It kind of spreads that sense of...
So with that, I'd like to talk to you about the piece of work that are my favourite pieces of work, which would be, I'd like to start with Eurostar, if that's okay. So I've shown the guys Eurostar before you came. I'd say it's, so people don't know, it's, how would you set it up? How would you describe the initial script when you first got it? What would you say was the initial idea?
The initial idea was just, up, down. We just want to go to these. We made two. So there's one shot in Paris and one shot in London. For the French audience, and the Paris one obviously was shot for the UK. The script was more or less the same. Up, down, left, right. We're going to go into here, out of there, meet this person, meet that person.
So that script was already a written script.
It was already a written script. I think probably some of the words changed.
Yeah. But when you saw that, I'd say that's an 8 out of 10 script, pretty much. I mean, would you agree? Was that pretty solid start?
Yeah, I think it possibly was. And the most memorable thing is that they took us into a room, their ideas room.
Was this BBH?
AMV.
AMV, yeah, right.
They took us into their ideas room and then said visually, this is what we're thinking it would look like. And we opened the door and all around every wall was filled
the best street
with images of the best street photography ever shot for like the last 100 years. Just big shots. So Bresson,
so they weren't ambitious,
Elliot,
at all then.
I mean, just really magical moments caught in cities, and a bit like this. and we've got got a couple of weeks, right? So I came out thinking, how are we going to do that? How are we going to give, because each of these images is just so layered. They have a little bit of charm, or they have a kind of a subtle belly laugh.
Yeah.
Or there's a little kid in the background that actually makes the joke when you have to spend time on the images. Lots of things.
You're talking about street photography images.
Just these references.
The sophistication of the images.
Irony
and the humor and humanity and all of that.
So all of that. And also we had a quite specific, it's going to be in Paris, and in Paris, and also maybe the kind of thing a tourist would do. So already it's limited. It's not just what's a wonderful image. And I think I came out and was there with Mike, my producer, and I just thought, if we get this job, I need to start filming the moment they confirm it, because we don't have enough days.
How many days were they proposing for the shoot?
Well, the problem was within both scripts, there's a story. So the one shot in Paris, you either walk past or you don't walk past a woman just standing in the rain. And then you take her out for dinner, she gets pregnant, you have babies, and then you go and buy a penguin. Right. So there was that little story towards the end, all needed to be shot. And there was another one in London where... it's a guy, and they go out to dinner, he has a baby, and then it's a suit of armor, So just those two scenes shot in those two cities was pretty much all their budget. That was it. They need to be properly cast, wardrobe. We need to find locations. And there were a couple of days each, and in two cities that's 4 days. That's a 4 day shoot. And we go, right, well, that's your money. And so we said, look, we're going to, on the recce, because we're going back, we're bouncing backwards and forwards to Paris and London. On the recce, we're going to take a camera and just grab stuff. And I think that's where it became, the recce became, the shoot.
And is that something that was at a watermark point for you in your career, going, well, hang on, if I can find a way of turning recces into shoots and expanding the shoot days, then I can get more of this found magic? And is that something that the strategy yes, a little bit.
I guess so. There it was an imperative. Mm. You know, we weren't going to be able to do it otherwise. But I guess it did.
And you were just shooting the stuff yourself then,
yes,
presumably.
Well, yeah. we had a couple of street photographers.
Yeah.
Working for us,
taking stills or
who were taking stills and yeah. little bits of video.
Yeah.
But you know, they're under huge pressure, you know, because it's not about street photography.
Yeah.
It's about finding something and then working a little bit because you don't have time. You don't have a month. Mm. You got a day and you need to come back with 10 images.
Mm.
And they might go for a year and come back with 10 images. Mm. So it's not really, they were great, but it wasn't as.
How much did the words guide their brief? When you gave them the brief, you know, like, so perhaps you see this person, or you see that person, you know, the sort of guides, because the thing that really worked so well for me in that commercial was that the images were unexpected to the words. You know, it's like it could have been so cliche and so obvious, and it wasn't. The images brought another level of depth to the words, which is the perfect kind of combination, really, isn't it?
I guess partly, we collected a lot, and so we were able in the edit to find slightly fresher ways of putting picture to words. But I think also the words themselves were so generic.
Mm.
You know, we went up, we went down.
Yeah, right.
So great. So anything that's actually going up or going down.
Mm.
And I think if you break down the shots against the words, any shot, it's not actually that brilliant. It's not a Cartier-Bresson.
Mm.
It just isn't. It's just somebody going up in a lift, or it's some pigeons flying up, or it's a you know, it's a girl winding an awning down.
Mm.
You know, nicely shot, grabbed, handheld, feels very real. You know, it is real. But that's all it is.
Mm.
But in the flow and that kind of flurry of images, which are all just somehow linked, and they're all doing some little up thing and then the down thing, you can get some really surprising cuts. Or you'll think you're doing something and then you're dropping and then you're in somewhere and then it's dark and then there's a weird face. And somehow it's a it's a great edit.
Yeah.
And it's the juxtaposition of images that somehow elevate them all.
Who edited that piece?
A guy called Adam Spivey.
Right. And what was your involvement in the edit? Do you give the same amount of freedom to the editor that you do with
he would try and assemble something. I mean, you know, there were two long films and we had just, you know, hours and hours of stuff that he had to sift through and then kind of order it.
Mm.
And the agency were very happy to be flexible on the script. If you've got no great lefts and rights, let's make it here and there.
Mm.
You know, that there are ways that we could juggle that and that also helped. The script pretty much was as it was written originally, but just being able to throw in a word or change a phrase would open up other shots. But that's difficult in the edit because it just gives you more options, more buttons, you know, more images that might be usable, which is probably why we stayed pretty close to the original script.
And that was before you did the Guardian ad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that the first time you really, because to me that's a kind of watershed moment for your work, that there's before Eurostar and then after Eurostar, or am I missing a piece of work? I mean, I think the Lerpak was the one before that was hinting at that.
Yeah.
But then for me, Eurostar was the time when you really found your own sort of voice in a way.
I guess it was just the most freedom.
Mm.
I was given the most freedom, and actually, and not willingly. I mean, once they realized they'd spent their budget, my producer really had to gently but very firmly not let them be involved at all in anything else we shot, because they're simply, what are they going to do? All they're going to do is slow the process down.
That was Mike, was it?
That's Mike, Mike Wells. Because we've got a mountain to climb, and we need hundreds of these images.
Yeah.
And I'm only going to know if it's good just as it happens,
right,
and I'll be filming it.
Yeah.
There won't be, well, we're not quite sure about the dog scene, or we're not quite sure of this, or worse, it would be, we were thinking maybe we could have a guy in a bar doing this. Or, you know, all there could be good ideas, but we're not in a bar. Mm. We're here. We'll be in a bar later, or maybe we're not. We're not in a bar at all. Mm. We're going to be heading back to London, and
it just was
going to be a practical impossibility to have people there watching me do what I was going to do.
But then it's also it's on Mike's time now. It's not on their clock has run out, right?
In terms of where they're going to spend their money.
Mm.
So we had already started filming, and they wanted to see the stuff, obviously, because they wanted to know that. We were getting good material, and there was no time to have meetings on this kind of stuff.
So hang on, so you shot the recce.
We began to shoot on the recce.
Then you shot the sort of structured shoot, and then you shot beyond that. Is that
after a little bit? Yeah. So you know, I would also shoot after the shoot and in the morning before the shoot.
Mm.
You know, if I was in Paris, I would just very briefly sleep. Yeah. Eat and then shoot.
Right.
And also, in fact, Martin
Hill.
Martin Hill did some filming for us as well.
In Paris or in London?
I think both.
Yeah.
And so he would take his camera out.
And he'd be going off on his own.
And he would just be going off on his own.
Yeah.
I mean, when he was in London, you know, the day before the shoot, he would just go out and grab a few things.
Yeah.
You know, people were just very up for contributing in that way, because it was, you know, small camera, and they've got the freedom to find something.
And it was all shot on DSLRs?
It was all DSLR, I think still the 5D.
Yeah.
And I think the freedom that the image makers had is on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly get that sense.
Yeah, yeah. And even when we then tried to slot in the little story sequences, they just initially didn't work at all.
Mm.
They
look clunky.
Clunky. It was totally... stood out, and I said, okay, let's make them stills. So we got all this, it's all shot, you know, moving images, and let's just go through each scene and just take one still, so they see each other, dinner, bed, baby, penguin, and then they just slotted right in.
That's the thing I loved about the efficiency of the particularly the French Paris one, was you saw her standing in the doorway, and then you saw the veil, and then you saw the bump in the bath, and that's all you needed to know. Yeah. Right? And I love the efficiency of that. That's someone's whole life there, just in three frames. Yeah,
but you know what the moments are. Yeah, you know what's happening.
Yeah.
But that somehow sat. You know, it felt embedded in naturally in the flow of the other images, rather than it being. And now we're going to tell this little kind of this little story. And I guess from that point then on, I really wanted to be free.
Yeah.
Because it's great stuff. Mm. I mean, it's limiting, because sometimes you just need lots of crew.
Mm.
And you just can't do certain things.
It's interesting how that translates, because I know with your American work, they're still very stuck in traditional sort of commercial, and you're trying to, you know, like, for example, I'm not sure if that's American or not, but the Land Rover ads, and it's almost like, it's like they saw Eurostar and said, can you get that, but with a bit more commercial structure around you? That's what it felt like to me. Was that an American ad?
I think I've done three Land Rover, so it depends on which one we're talking about.
But the one with the voice that's saying, it's a very similar voiceover to, it's using the words, and it's on your website, and it's the one where different climates, all
the lot of weather going on.
So
that was it had to, because they need a lot of different weather, and hard to really write that, because we just might get sun. I've done actually a lot of weather related things, and you can find weather.
When the wind was blowing, was that fans, or was that done for real?
There is the opening shot, two girls on a cliff.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that is with a wind machine that never made it.
Right.
And it's pretty hard to get that kind of wind.
Mm, mm.
And unless you really have got a helicopter.
Mm.
And there was no money for that. Mm. And the production service company said, we'll just get a wind machine and stick that on a cliff somewhere.
Mm.
So we kind of noted this location. We hadn't properly been there. And then on the day, they just couldn't get the wind machine. You know, it was just a totally useless thing. And it really left us exposed, literally, because it was just going to be an interesting shot.
Mm.
And it was just really windy on the edge.
Right.
So we just said, okay, just lean as much as you can into the wind.
Yeah.
And I think in post, we just lent a little bit more.
Right.
You can't even tell the cheat.
Yeah.
We just added 15 degrees or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really windy. But there was wind there. So, they're there. Because there's a drop there. And there's no way, even if we could have got the wind machine, we couldn't have framed that there because they had to be further back and all of that stuff. So we just got lucky.
Yeah,
there was just enough wind to make it
and
real.
Do you schedule these jobs to have enough time to be able to find these? You know, with the weather, the different weathers that you were looking.
I think it's more about scheduling where you think you might find stuff and where you need to be to get two or three things, whatever they might be. Particularly with the weather, because it's so unexpected, and you don't know quite what's going to take up your time. Mm. So I guess it's about. We need something in the mountains. We need something on the beach. We need something in the city. We need something, we'll do a morning of that.
Mm.
It will only take us half an hour to change locations. We'll spend an afternoon there. And let's just hope the weather is different. And finding, and generally with weather stuff, I mean, I've shot around Snowdon, and that was shot all around, I think, Cumbria and the west of Cumbria. Because you get four seasons in a day. We shot it in February and we had a storm come in. So there's a shot in the middle of it or early on where a wave hits a quay going out to sea. And that was the smallest one we had because the client got worried that if it was going to be reported that people had lost their lives when the storm hit, they don't want to be reminded. We had massive waves hitting the coast, all on film.
Right.
I mean, it was just... If you wanted a film about the weather, I mean, it was just, it was perfect, absolutely perfect. And the sun came out. So the moment the sun came out, wherever we were and whatever we were doing, we'd shoot something in the sun. So sometimes that would just be, we've got to do something right now because the sun could be gone in 15 minutes. But we need some sun.
Yeah.
And then you might find yourself by a farm. And I think we had these three girls and they just started doing, they had to do something. It was like a field.
So be so nimble as you are, you can take advantage of this because you seem to be quite a lucky director when it comes to finding the right weather. Because I remember when I first saw the Bloodbath, the Blood Circus.
Yeah, Bloody Circus.
Bloody Circus. Yeah, that you had amazing work because that was shot in London, in the UK, wasn't it? In London.
Yeah.
But it looks like it was Iraq, right?
Yeah.
In December?
Yeah. The shortest day, like the 19th, 20th and 21st of December, the shortest days of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was literally dark. And then we had, but of course what it does is it gives you really low sun that stays low all day.
Wonderful, yeah.
So we had three clear days of sun.
Yeah. So obviously you've developed this, you've been developing this sort of kind of humanist, sort of naturalist style of just finding these beautiful moments, a kind of documentary sort of magic realist type thing. But also there's another sort of through line through some of your work of finding a kind of technique and developing a technique or finding something kind of a unique way of doing something visually. For example, the boots campaign, did the idea come to you as a POV of the boot? Was that the kind of initial idea? And did you have to develop any special kind of routes for that?
Again, just really my practical head. Mm. It was a story about boots.
Mm.
They weren't quite sure how to film it, but they wanted a something that felt like a new technique. I don't really like the term technique. It feels like it's somehow like some kind of stylistic tool that kind of gets in the way of the emotion of it. But they wanted something visually a little bit different, let's say that. And it just had to be the story of the boots, and you know, we follow it through, and you kind of get the, you know, on the page you read it, and it was literally like one line, you know, recruitment. They get their uniform, they're on parade. You know, you could imagine the lines. This is how we imagine, you know, what would be the life of someone going into a recruitment office, becoming a trained soldier, and then going to the front line. You just, it's pretty quick to write, and that's all they're done. You know, the list of these sentences, shot, you know, we just follow the boots, not the person. So great idea. You know, that's one of those very pure ideas. There's nothing in it that broke that. It was
uncomplicated.
Just, and also I felt there's gonna be lots of freedom here, because how do we know it's gonna be a good shot? But we need scenes. But the main thing is how do I tell a story of the boots? How do I move the camera? And is it a POV? Is it? And I just thought about it and thought, actually, you know, what I really want is I want a really tiny, really fast film crew who can just move with the camera. I just need the camera right by the boots. But we need loads of shots, and we're in mud, and we're in rain, and we're jumping out of helicopters, and we're climbing assault courses. How are we going to track? How are you even going to kind of steadicam this? And they're running, they're sprinting or climbing, or steadicam guy is not going to be able to do that. How do we keep up with them? Without, we can do any one of these shots, but how do we do it for 50 shots in a couple of days? This is never going to happen. Each shot is going to be a big setup, and there's got to be like a lo-fi way of doing this. And so I was at home, and I thought, well, maybe we attach the camera to the boots. And then you can just go off and do something. It's got to be as simple as this. So I literally got some clamps and a little camera. Remember that little kind of Lumix thing I had? And if you screwed that into a tripod and just clamped and put some walking boots on and clamped the camera to the back of one of my walking boots and then just pressed record and just walked around the garden and then came back into the house, took the camera off and watched the footage. Oh my God. You know, it turned me into a one-legged disabled amputee, because nothing would move. And then you'd just see one foot, and then the camera would just go crazy and then stop. And then this leg would come in. And I thought, no, this is not the technique that they're looking for. But what it did immediately tell me is that it can't be attached to the feet, because I want to see both feet. So I still need this little film crew down by my leg. They've got to be separate. They can't be attached to my knee, my leg. They can't be attached to the body, because if it is, this is going to look weird. And then it's going to really be a technique thing, which I think POV is a bit like that, because the camera's attached to the body, isn't it? It just feels a bit heavy-handed sometimes. And how do I get a camera? And so I just put the camera on the floor, and I thought, okay, that's where I want it to be. I want it to be about a foot away. And the moment I step forward, it moves with me. So how am I going to do that? I thought, well, maybe if I turn it upside down and just stick a tripod, I'll just carry it. So I did that. I got a tripod.
Monopod?
Well, I think it was a tripod, but just with the legs shut.
Oh, it's legs shut, right, yeah.
With the camera upside down, and then started to walk and looked at the footage. And thought, That's it. Because, and then suddenly I realized I could do a lot of things. Because I'm holding it. It's connected to me in a way that a crew and a soldier can never be connected. That they're always going to be looking for focus, always going to be looking for what's he about to do? Is he about to jump, stop, leap? Whereas if the soldier's holding the camera, he knows he's about to stop. He knows he's about to climb. Even if it's just one step and then we do the next shot, he can start that process, because he's only got one hand. Or maybe we're walking along beside him with the camera held upside down on a monopod. But that's how to do it. So whether we're connected or not, generally, the person should be the cameraman. And because it's boots, it can be the cameraman. You know, he just needs to wear some khaki trousers and the same pair of boots. And the cameraman just shoots himself. And all we need to do is fill the background with army people.
Yeah, right.
And then let's not give them the camera. They will just, it's not going to work. And they loved that idea, and so that worked. And it was just so simple. It was just such a simple, and I could go anywhere with it and shoot stuff and just flip it the other way around. And you could spin the camera around you. You could absolutely stop dead still, and the camera would move with you, without it being, and still be kind of handheld, without it being locked to you.
Where was it shot? Was it a majority shot in the UK?
Majority shot in the UK, and then we went for I think we're out for a couple of days in Cyprus, where there's a British Army base, just to shoot some stuff, live ammunition. What were kind of training exercises, but just to make it look like the chap had landed on the front line. So,
and the snow scene, where was that?
So,
was that fake
well,
snow?
The snow is no, the snow is simply part of. You asked very early on about whether some of the stuff, how big the job is, how you know, whether it's just me going out by myself or whether it's just it's just a huge crew going for days and days. And there's sometimes you can just shoot something which adds a massive amount of scale, but it's just one shot. And in there's three shots. So I went to Dartmoor and it was kind of autumn and everything was burnt. Or maybe it was still burned because there was snow. I mean, we weren't shooting for months, so we must have shot it in the around March, April. But anyway, Dartmoor was completely black. It was this hillside was black, and I had my camera. I thought I was going to shoot some stuff walking through this black stuff.
That was just you and the camera. Happened.
Yeah, and then
Dartmoor.
I came back home and it snowed. It was just enough snow for about 2 days.
Yeah.
And so I just went for walks in the snow.
Yeah.
Because as long as I had a similar pair of boots and a pair of trousers, it looked like I'm on some kind of training thing. And then I found some frozen puddles. Okay, let's walk through the ice. Because in a week, this is gone.
Mm. Yeah, right.
And then we just carried on.
For me, that's what made it a believable kind of life in a, you know, life of a boot. Because you had the range. If you didn't have the range, it would have felt more like a commercial. Right?
Yeah.
And that range gave it the believability.
And I think sometimes if you've got an idea that you can execute yourself, even if it's not as polished as some of the other shots because of the requirements of that and the setups and the people involved. Mm. If there are a couple of things you can just go away and shoot by yourself, why would I not do that?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not going to happen. You know, they're not going to spend the money. I think originally there was some snow training, but you know they haven't got the money to send us to Norway to do one or two shots.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just suddenly snowed. I thought, okay, all we need is just somebody walking through snow.
Mm.
Like it's on some kind of march.
You've already worked the technique out and you knew it was going to slot in perfectly. So,
totally.
Yeah. One of the things that I really do have to ask, because we do have an actually kind of rough structure here that I don't ever keep to, but one of the things that I would like to ask you is what advice you would give to the young filmmakers? You know, I mean, they're going to glean a lot from the conversations you're having about how you kind of, you know, how you've found your own way through the industry and how you, you know, you've kind of found a way of creating this sort of magic yourself. And working, you know, in any scale, you can still have that as a process. But what is there any set bits of advice? Like, for example, is there a lesson that you've learned that you'd say is your biggest lesson, apart from the one you mentioned earlier about the chaos, organized chaos kind of thing? Is there any other lessons?
Yeah, I guess off the back of the boots thing, I would say, you know, just never be fearful of trying something new. I think it took me a day. So I shot some stuff. It kind of worked. Loved the technique. Knew it was going to be good. Arrive on set, first day. Don't see the camera for like 3 hours. And I'm thinking, what is going on? Because it's just a camera on the end of a pole. And I kept saying, you're almost there. Okay. And eventually they came out. And this monopod was totally rigged. With a monitor, you know, throwing a feed to another camera,
yeah.
Follow focus, all of these things, and it was just really heavy, and awkward because the person carrying it who's actually a big New Zealand guy was just looking at the monitor all the time, and we weren't quite sure where the focus was. And I said, look guys, we don't need any of this. It's all going to work. We just don't need any of this. As long as you're pointing it to your foot, it's good. And DAP was saying, yeah, but you know, what about the focus? You know, we need to see what's going on, so we know what's in focus. I said, no, just set the focus, because the boots are never going to be in focus. They're moving. The ground will in focus. Yeah. Don't worry about that. Just set it. Just
strip it all down.
So they took one thing off. Mm. And then by lunchtime, they took another couple of things on. By the end of the day, it was a pole with a camera.
Mm.
And we just took the cards out.
Mm.
because then we could run. We could run. We never had to look in the monitor. And so my trying to find something, a new way of doing something. I discovered something which I think was great, but it had a problem trying to then, for that idea to translate into a film crew, how to work with that idea, because they're so used to trying to deliver the very best thing possible.
Yeah.
And this just required them to unlearn all of that and strip everything away. So they were totally vulnerable. They could just kind of guess the focus and guess that the camera's being pointed in more or less the right direction. All of this stuff was very, very against their instincts, and rightly so. But coming back to the advice, don't be frightened of that, because it's those little techniques you'll find will get you out of jail in so many situations, and will allow you to do something new. And once you're there and you're doing it, you realize actually it's giving us something else that we wouldn't have got in another way, and it's okay not to have those constraints. We've got a different set of constraints, but they work with this. To be bold with being innovative, not worry about how you're going to film it.
But the thing that's to your kind of credit is the fact that you've always got a truth antenna. You're always looking for the emotional truth. Like you were saying earlier, a cold technique on its own is gratuitous, but when it has some emotional, when it's a device to get you to the emotional truth, or to show you a view of something that you haven't seen before, then it's got some value, right?
Yes, and I think hard with boots, they are what they are. But with people, I think it's just, would I do that? Is that how I behave? And particularly in commercials, it is full of scenarios that are written that sound really great. But when you read them, you go, well, actually, that's not what someone would do. It's quite close to it, but it's not what they would do.
So that's the filter you always put the thought process through.
Yes, I am constantly trying to make something that looks real. Very rarely is it. It's always got some control, and that's part of my problem. A lot of the stuff they think, oh, you just gone out and shot this. No, I haven't. We own these people. They're performing for us. We're in this location. They're doing what we say. But I'm only interested in coming away with shots that people don't think we set up.
Yeah.
That to me is, now it's time to leave. We can go, because that's totally believable. And often those moments are believable because you've created the stage and you created the circumstances where something just kind of happens. And that little something that happens is actually real. And on script.
Yeah.
And so it's giving cast just really as much freedom and camera people freedom. Everybody freedom just to do their thing, and then you'll just get stuff that is just more real. If you try and get a baby to do something, you try and get a dog to do a specific thing, it's always going to be just a little bit awkward. But if you just let the dog show us what it's going to do, but let's turn over the cameras, and then the dog will just do something great, and we go, okay, that's better than the original idea, and it's totally natural, and we haven't said anything. Once you get into the world of trying to really control something to be very, very, very tightly executed, that often does squeeze the naturalism. But you can get quite specific bits of performance from people just by redoing it, changing a few of the parameters, and letting them do it in their own way. And just by maybe shifting the camera slightly or just intensifying the action, whatever it might be, if it's repeatable, you'll eventually get them to do something in a way that is real, and particularly real families and real partners. If they're going to kiss or smile or hug each other, it's a genuine thing. Really, really, with people, the more they are connected in some way, then they'll respond to each other in a natural way. And it may not be the first thing they do. They may be awkward, but eventually they'll do something which is totally natural.
Yeah. Look, just to sort of to wind up now and to summarize, one of the things I think, well, I knew this about you anyway, but I want to sort of state it out there, is that you manage to get this naturalism, but you do it in a magic realist way. You do it in a way that's magical and emotional. At the same time, you get the naturalism, but you do it. And I believe that's because that's the way you see the world. Knowing you as a person, as we've known each other for 20 years, you have a sort of a very optimistic, very kind of sort of poetic view of the world, and you manage to somehow get that through in your work. It's very clear to me when I see your work as a body of work, you know, having watched it over the last few days of just doing research again, refreshing myself of some of the work you've done, I really do see it as a body of work, and it really has got your voice like imprinted on everything you do. And it is, I would say, if I was to sum it up, I'd say it's Simon's view of the world. And not everyone has that, but I mean, our audience out there, they all have their own way of viewing the world. And I think the kind of the takeaway from this is that find out your, you know, it's like find your voice and find what your view of the world is, and then have the confidence to find the techniques in order to make that happen on the film set, which is what you, exactly what you've done. You started off, you always had your voice. As long as I've known you, you've always been the same Simon. You've always been this creative kind of force. But what you've managed to do throughout your career is found a way of getting, like I said earlier, getting the commercial industry to sort of bend to your will, and to you find ways of dealing with agency, of dealing with clients, dealing with producers, dealing with film sets generally, DOPs, everyone. Like the last example of the stripping down the stick, right? You bend people to your view because you're extremely confident creatively, and you have this view of the world, which is your view of the world, and you've never doubted it for a moment. So anyway, that's, I just wanted to sort of sum up.
Yeah, I can't really reply to that. But, well, it's just the world is a great place and real people are really interesting. And if you just don't say anything, something wonderful happens.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You just confirmed my belief that by saying that something wonderful will happen. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure, man. I mean,
great.
There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about. So if you do have any time in the future, we'll probably going to try and ask you back for a part two.
That's totally fine. And I was late today, so.
And that's on us. So yeah, but right. Yeah. So it's been my pleasure.
Lovely talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome.